Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We always appreciate your time and attention. And have you had a nice conversation lately with someone you disagree with? No, you're not alone, either now or in history. We explored this in a chat 3 years ago. We replay that now. And because it's pre-recorded, no new phone calls or emails today. You only have to watch a few minutes of cable TV news or the proceedings of Congress on C-SPAN to get a grasp of the level of discourse between opposing points of view in America. It's not pretty, and it's no surprise that many of us shy away from engaging in dialogue with people we know we already have a disagreement with. But it was possible once, and it is still possible today, and our guest today gives us some history and ideas. Sharon Schumann is the author of the book Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World. She comes to us from Oregon. She taught literature and interdisciplinary studies at the University of Oregon, at Oregon State University, at Willamette University, and Deep Springs College as well. We're glad to have her here on the Jefferson Exchange. Sharon, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
So what was the original push to write this book?
Well, I've been thinking about freedom just like most of us have for most of my life. When I was young, I couldn't wait to get out from under my family's control and burst forth into the world. And I think a lot of us think about freedom a lot of the time. But I got more interested in it when I began to team teach with political theorists back at Deep Springs College some years ago. And I continued to do that kind of interdisciplinary work throughout my career. And so my background is in literature, but I developed a great interest in all of these ideas from Hannah Arendt and Aristotle and Isaiah Berlin and John Stuart Mill, you know, just all the people you would read who talk about freedom. And meanwhile, history was going by and our culture was getting more and more polarized. And it eventually occurred to me that the ways we think about freedom could be improved.
So people do discuss freedom a lot, as you point out, and in fact, it seems to be a bit shriller, if I can venture that that observation, over the course of the last 10 to 15 years anyway, where freedom is almost shouted.
Yes, like many other things.
Right, okay. You discuss, your preface alone might surprise a few people, because you discuss freedom in terms beyond just the individual.
Yes, and that's important. I'm glad you noticed that. Because our usual way of thinking about freedom, I think for most of us, is, and I don't think that this is a bad way to think about freedom, it's just not the only way we ought to do it. Leave me alone to do what I want as long as I don't hurt anybody else. I need to be free to do that. Most of us think about that. Don't you think about that?
Well, sure, and we hear it a lot from other people. It's like, you know, it's the freedom to be left alone is one of the things that people talk about a lot in America. Yeah,
and I really think that that's a big part of our background, and you could almost say the wallpaper of our lives. There's another way of thinking about freedom that is also really, really common, and I think about it this way. Other people think about it this way. If you're at all religious, you think about being free to be your complete self by following your deity, say, or you've heard the phrase, the truth will set you free. You might think of it from a philosophical perspective, or maybe it's a political orientation for you. At any rate, the form that it takes for us today often is, you'd be a lot freer if you just thought about things the way I do, because I'm enlightened and I see the truth, capital T. Whether it's from my God or from my political orientation or from my philosophical orientation or whatever, you know. So we have this really, I consider to be a dangerous combination of wanting to be left alone and knowing that we're right already. And it tends to make us want to surround ourselves with people who already agree with us, completely dismiss people who don't agree with us. And I think it contributes to the polarization in our culture, and that if we thought about freedom in a different way, which you just alluded to, we'd be better off.
It's almost hermit-like, then, the way you describe it, though. It's the freedom to be left alone, but the freedom to be left alone with the people who think just the way I do.
Exactly. Because, you know, none of us truly want to be totally isolated, at least. Most of us who are sane have connections to other people. But, you know, we like to surround ourselves with people who already agree with us. Look at all the people who watch either left-wing talk shows or right-wing talk shows because they don't want to really hear the other side. We don't really want to be truly alone. We like to say we want to be left alone to do as we please, but we really want to be surrounded by people who agree with us, and I think that's a problem.
In some senses, though, what you describe, particularly when you get to the talk shows, it's almost like the freedom to be angry.
Well, I think that indignation and anger are a big part of dismissing anybody who would dare to disagree with you.
So who is the intended audience here, Sharon? And when you wrote Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World, who were you hoping to that would pick this up and read this and use it, perhaps?
Well, you know, I'm quite a dreamer, so I hoped that everyone intelligent who is interested in freedom would really want to read this book. And I didn't really write it for students in a literature class only, or students in a political theory class only, or philosophers only, or linguists only. There's a lot of different disciplines that it treads through, but I tried throughout to write in a style that was completely transparent and jargon-free and linked to our contemporary world. I crave books like that are intellectually stimulating, but really relate to the issues that I'm most interested in my daily life. So I was trying to write it for everybody.
Are you hoping that people read the book and start talking to each other?
Yes.
Now, that was a definitive answer. We'll get further into Sharon Schumann's ideas for how people can talk to each other, taking note of great examples from history. The book is Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World. We'll get back to the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Sharon Schumann is a prolific writer and teacher. She taught literature and interdisciplinary seminars at the University of Oregon, Oregon State, Willamette University, and other places. She's given us a guide from some of the great works of literature for having conversations with people who hold viewpoints different from our own. Dialogic freedom is her term, explained at length in her book Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World. We visited with Sharon Schumann 3 years ago and got several calls. You'll hear them, but we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. So obviously, since you are a teacher of literature, you're going to think that literature is a key to developing understanding. But broaden this out for the rest of us, though, who don't spend as much time with literature as you do.
Well, you know, I write about literature partly because I'm trained with literature, and also because, you know, in our daily lives, we have a lot of distractions. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of chaos. If you pick up a work of literature, any work of literature that's any good, it's a complete world. It's right there for you to just enjoy and take in. And so I think sometimes it's easier to think about things by looking at a work of literature that totally makes sense in some way to you. And I picked these moments from literature, really great literature, that are moments of choice, so we could see how this concept of freedom that I'm trying to advocate, how it really works. And I loved writing about this literature, but I didn't presume that the people who would read the book would have read all of this literature. There's about 8 or 9 works that I discuss, but I just pick a certain moment of choice in the literature, and I describe it, and I quote from whatever it is. And it's not necessary to have read the literature to enjoy the book. I really wanted to set it up that way, that it would just bring the subject alive.
I did notice that. I mean, even when you went back to the writings of Homer and The Merchant of Venice and a number of other works that are all in here, you didn't have to have read those works to understand, which is really helpful to the person who's reading your book. Come back to a point, though, a little more broad than what we're talking about with literature. The huge number of issues that are expressed as freedom, as we've already described in the earlier segment, freedom versus harm. Explain that double edge.
Okay. That's one of the most important ways in which we think about freedom, and it all goes back to John Stuart Mill and On Liberty, because he's the first one to really articulate for a lot of people to read this idea that I should be able to do as I please as long as I don't harm somebody else. The harm principle, as it's referred to, it's the only thing that can limit my freedom justly in his mind and in many people's minds. And so the funny thing about that is that it sounds good, but what if you and I disagree about what harms somebody else, you know? And I'll give you as the example something I write about in my book, because I wanted to show contemporary applications of these ideas. So I talked about abortion, and I wasn't really trying to get people upset about abortion and inflame the discussion. I was really trying to do the opposite. And one of the things I was pointing out is that both sides, whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, they agree that we should be free to do as we please as long as we don't harm somebody. They just disagree very fundamentally about what the harm constitutes. And in the abortion debate, right now there are laws about when the fetus becomes a human being. And that's part of the Roe versus Wade decision. I'm not a legal scholar at all, but I know this much. And because the fetus isn't considered a person until after the first trimester, it's technically not possible to harm it. Well, in the pro-life movement, a lot of the impetus is on getting the fetus recognized as a person from the moment of conception, because if that were to happen, well, then the harm principle would kick in right then, and abortions would be illegal. So you see how even the way you think about, I should be free to do as I please, unless I harm somebody, that enters right into the center of some of our most polarized discussions and debates. This thinking is so fundamental to us.
It really is about where you draw the line then.
Exactly. And it's very hard. You know, if somebody's drinking themselves to death, you know, an alcoholic, and they say, I should be free to drink as much as I want. But somebody else will say, but what about your children? What about your brother and your sister? What about the society that has to pay the bill when you get hauled off to the emergency room and suddenly it's costing a lot to the taxpayers to take care of you? Aren't you harming them? So, you see, it's always a big debate about what constitutes harm and to whom, and Mill realized that, and he devoted a lot of On Liberty to discussing that problem.
So, Sharon Schumann, the central concept of freedom and dialogue in a polarized world is dialogic freedom.
Yes.
And what does that mean?
Okay. I knew you'd ask that, and I hoped you'd ask that. Now, we're talking on the phone, so I cannot see your face. If I were right in the same room with you and I could see your face, I would see whether you're looking at your watch and kind of bored and hoping that the next segment comes up really quick. Or no, I heard a laugh. So I know that you're really actually responding to me. You're even smiling. You were laughing. If you're looking at me in an encouraging way and we're just looking at each other and I'm talking, I'm going to be encouraged to talk more. If you're completely shutting down or looking angry or looking bored or looking like you're going to fall asleep, then I might be inspired to say more, try to justify myself better, or I might just think, oh, let's give up and go somewhere else. This is over. In that sense, just talking with somebody else, what comes out of my mind, what comes out of my mouth is a product of what you do in the way of responding to me, not just what I'm thinking and want to communicate, you know? So it's dialogic. It involves dialogue. Dialogic just means it involves dialogue. So I take that idea and say it's not just talking with somebody else, but it's taking action. Also involves our anticipated responses from each other. It involves the things we hold dear, being answerable to our values, being answerable to whatever God we might worship, having a sense of the family influences. We care about what our husbands and wives might think, or our responsibilities to our children or our friends. All kinds of things that we hold important, the law. We take that into consideration when we decide to do something. And the more aware we are of these influences in our lives that I'm calling dialogic, because we're answering to them and we're taking them into consideration, the more we're aware of that, the more we can understand ourselves And the more we are aware of those forces in other people's lives, say who might disagree with us, the better we can understand them. But the leap that I really want people to take with me here is that normally when we think about freedom to be left alone, say, the more I'm left alone, the freer I am. What I'm saying is the better we are able to empathize with others, to see things from their perspectives, to see the multiple forces in our own lives that influence our decisions, the better we are able to understand all of that, the better we are able to make choices that we will be proud of, and the more free we will feel.
So understand, first off, what the various forces and biases that shaped you are as you enter into this dialogue. So there's much more than just this moment of dialogue, but years and years of experiences leading up to it for you and for the other person.
Right. And, you know, thinking of it as two-sided, you know, you're talking with me right now and I'm talking with you and we're deciding to talk about what we're deciding to talk about. We're making choices all the time. So that's a very simple way to think about dialogue. But what you're pointing out, which I appreciate, is that it becomes much more complicated than that because there's many voices rattling around in our heads. And in fact, we have to go through a constant organizing and sifting process to decide which are the voices that are most important to listen to how do we evaluate all of the things that are going into the making of a decision in our own lives at moment by moment, you know. So it's not that simple a process, but the concept of the dialogue aspect of it is pretty straightforward.
Sharon Schumann is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She has taught literature and interdisciplinary studies at Oregon State, University of Oregon, Deep Springs College, and Willamette University. She's the author of Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World. Here's Cindy in Neyland, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sharon Schumann.
Hi, this is a really interesting subject, and I'm so glad that, as you frequently do, you take time with it, which most places don't, you know. 5-second interviews and everything's over. I had a question about her perspective I personally believe that part of what's going on with the actual bitterness that is so prevalent in this country is that government, both the Democrats and Republican parties, have decided to divide people for different reasons, but they've done it. For instance, the Republicans might want to reduce taxes, so they target maybe somebody specific for it. And then the Democrats want to help these specific people, so they target the same group. And basically what we've ended up with is people who are, instead of laws that apply to everybody, we have more and more targeted groups. And you can be a member of multiple groups, but on the whole, you know, it's rich and poor and Democrat and Republican and rural and city and young and old. And instead of emphasizing what benefits everybody, which I think laws can, it benefits just a specific group, as I said, for different reasons among different people. But that has happened more and more and more, especially as money gets tighter. And I just wanted to hear her philosophy or her thoughts on that.
All right. Thanks very much, Cindy. Appreciate it.
That's a great question. Why do we focus on these specific groups rather than everybody as a whole? I think a lot of people will find the concept of general welfare an attractive concept, but a little bit overwhelming because it's hard to wrap your mind around the whole population. And also, our society works through passing laws. That's what we do. And this all relates to your views of freedom because actually laws are passed to protect the rights of somebody. And now we're getting to your interest in noticing that it's always these specific groups that are benefited or hurt or whatever. We pass laws to protect people in one way or another, laws that restrict abortion or that make it more available, laws that restrict gun ownership or make it more available. And we do that because somebody is trying to protect the rights that they consider important. And rights are the way you protect the freedom to do as you please until you hurt somebody. So we have a very rights-oriented culture, which is a very law-oriented culture, which is a very duke it out in the court system or at the ballot box by electing the people you want to elect so that you can win or lose on the subject that's targeted to the group that you're noticing at the moment with the law that you want to pass. That's how we do things. And it has its virtues because little by little by little, we may wind up protecting something that really needs protecting. But you can see the drawbacks because it encourages people to dig in the trenches, on their perspective, and fight to win. And that doesn't really promote conversation or dialogue empathy.
And the concept of winning and losing, as it's currently defined, would seem to be, particularly in Congress, I win when you lose. Even if it's not a clear victory for me, you losing makes it a victory for me.
Yeah, you don't hear too much conversation about win-win situations.
Not anymore.
Between Republicans and Democrats.
Mm-mm.
It's I win, you lose. And if I lose, I only lose temporarily till I regroup my forces and go about it to try to win next time. It's really too bad that we are caught in that kind of a mindset right now.
Let's take another call. Here's Skeeter in Eugene. Go ahead, Skeeter.
Hi, Jeffrey. Hi, Sharon. Thank you.
Hi.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the polarized world aspect. I'm really encouraging all of us to remember that deep down we're earthlings. We're all a bunch of creatures on this planet, this round rock in the void. We've got a lot of problems, and things are getting kind of heavy. And we're either going to work it out and get through this, or we're going to eat each other up. And this whole nationalism competition of football teams, we're going to kick your butt. This whole macho trip, this patriarchy on the planet, it's got to stop. I mean, we've got to really get some empathy here and really start listening to each other. We've got to work it out. And I really appreciate what you're doing, so thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Skeeter. Appreciate it. So empathy, how do we exercise empathy in a situation of dialogue without going overboard? Is there some recommendation you make about?
I'm absolutely fascinated by empathy. I have to say that one of my inspirations for this book was the work of Mikhail Bakhtin, a Russian linguist and philosopher and literary thinker who lived under Stalin and suffered greatly, and his works are still being rediscovered and translated into English. He's kind of a contemporary influence, even though he lived under Stalin, but that was a parenthesis. But anyway, he wrote about empathy in really interesting ways and got me thinking about empathy, and I do write about it considerably in the book. And as an exercise for any of your listeners who actually thumb through my book, go to the index, look up empathy, and see the different juxtapositions that you can work with in the pages of my book without, you can make it a different book by just reading it through the index. But anyway, empathy, it's really important to be able to try to see things from somebody else's perspective. And I agree with the caller that this isn't just a luxury. This is something that we really need to cultivate right now and make our lives more rich, more meaningful, and more responsible in this world, which is a fragile world that we're a part of. I really agree with that. But one of the things I got fascinated by was the ways in which empathy could go wrong. And I just want to give you one little example from literature, naturally.
Uh-huh.
Dante, when he wrote the Inferno, probably the part of it that's most famous that everybody who ever reads the Inferno remembers is the lovers Paolo and Francesca, who are condemned to hell for the lust that led to the adultery that led them to both being murdered in the act.
I should point out the section heading in the book is called Dialogic Freedom in Hell. Gotta love that, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, at the end of Canto 5, where Dante, the pilgrim who's going through hell with Virgil, his guide, encounters these lovers. At the end of that canto, where he's just been listening to Francesca tell her sorrowful tale about how much she loved and how she got killed and her lover got killed and everything, he listens to that story, and Dante, the poet, who's writing the Inferno, is commenting on it all. So he looks at himself, and at the end of this encounter, the pilgrim faints out of empathy. Okay, he just faints. And I just have to give you one short line of the Inferno in Italian here, just for a second. It's so beautiful. Dante says, "E caddi come corpo morto cadde," which was, "I fell like a dying body falls." Kind of a description of that. Is that a fainting? I fell like a dying body falls. I'll tell you what's important about that when we come back.
Gotta love a guest who knows to break music. Sharon Schumann and Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World. You'll hear the rest of the interview when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Many of us wonder how to have conversations with political and philosophical opponents. It seems nearly impossible in today's world. Sharon Schumann, writer and teacher, looks to literature of the past for examples. She wrote about it in Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World. The interview was from 3 years ago, so sorry, no new phone calls or emails today. So we're talking about Dante and Dialogic Freedom in Hell, and your Italian pronunciation sounds spot on. Certainly heard the corpo in there, so this body falling as in death when it's just a fainting.
Yeah, okay. This is all about empathy, all right? Because that's what you were asking
about. So we got started, sure.
Yeah, and empathy is a good thing. I think empathy is a great thing. But, like all great things, you can go too far. And so here is Dante in the Inferno doing this incredible job of showing how he's looking on himself as the pilgrim who met Francesca, empathizing with her and fainting because her story of suffering and love is so poignant. It just makes him faint out of empathy. But the poet says in the beginning of the next canto, when I returned to myself from this experience, I went on to, you know, the next thing. The point being that he almost lost himself in this empathy. You can empathize with someone so much that their suffering becomes your suffering. And the interesting person, Mikhail Bakhtin, would say is, you can't help. All you can do is re-experience the suffering as they did. And you're paralyzed. What they really need is a helping hand. You have to stand back. You have to keep one foot anchored in your own reality or you can't help. And so it's just interesting that Dante found such an interesting, beautiful way to describe the dangers of his empathy, because, after all, Francesca is in hell for a reason. She wasn't sorry that she committed adultery. She wasn't even responsible for it. If you hear her story, love made her do it. It was such a powerful force. It just swept her off her feet. And, of course, our ideas about romantic love are often just that. But when it comes right down to it, you and I, we have to take responsibility for what we do. We have to be responsible for our own actions. So whenever we step forward and say, well, I wasn't really responsible for that. I did it, but it wasn't my fault. We know that that's the sociopath in us talking.
All right, we actually have talked to somebody about the sociopath in us, but that's a totally different discussion.
Sorry.
That's all right. Sharon Schumann, our guest, Mike in Eagle Point on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. The book is Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World.
Good morning.
Hi.
I lived for a number of years on a South Pacific island republic that had 106 different indigenous languages, and each language group was to one degree or another hostile to its neighbors. And I learned from that experience, I think, that we are, as human beings, tribal by nature, and it is our tendency to divide ourselves into groups and to regard everybody who's outside our group as the other. And we have to work extra hard in order to overcome that sense, or to invite the other into being our groups. And in that particular instance, you or I could look at these people and not recognize a difference between Mantana and Manhambai and Manambram, but they all understood who is who amongst themselves, and it caused animosity. I think that's a very deep-seated tendency among humans. You know, we band together in groups for our mutual benefit, but the dark side of tribalism is this tendency to be hostile to those outside the group. And whether it's politics or religion or sports or ethnicity or language, we just have to step back and remind ourselves that this person is this other person is as much a human being as we are, and deserves to be treated with an element of dignity.
All right. Thanks for that, Mike. Appreciate it. Sharon, your thoughts?
Well, you know, I agree with that completely, and I think the listener is on to something about the whole idea of how we're unified in our groups, and part of what makes us our group is our feelings about the others as outside of the group. But I want to extend that beyond the way we think about people to the way we think, period. One of the things I talk about in my book is that life would be impossible if we tried to register everything that's going on around us all the time. And so, or if we tried to just live in a world that didn't make sense to us. So we're always trying to make sense out of things. Humans are meaning-making animals, and we're always trying to unify our world.
We look for patterns. We look for patterns.
We look for patterns. We look for friends. We look on the communal level to a unified group of people who share our ideas. But even in other ways, we divide the day into hours. We have a concept of time. We have a concept of God. We have a concept of the law. There's all sorts of things that we do to make things make sense. And when we do that, we're always organizing material that doesn't really want to make sense. I mean, it doesn't have a will. It's just chaotic. It's just out there. So what I like to think about is that we have these dual impulses in our life. One is to hunker down and make sense of things, and the other is to acknowledge just how chaotic and full of variety everything out there is, and all the people out there are, so that we're balancing these forces between unity and chaos all the time, that this is a balancing act that we are going through every day, every moment of our lives. And now some of the ways that we unify things, you could say, are really healthy, and some of them are not so good. For instance, my family, when I was growing up, pretty racist, and the vision they had of people of color was what I would consider to be not healthy. That was a very unified vision, though. Those people aren't like us. They're on the outside, just what the caller was talking about.
It was consistent in your family. Yeah.
Yeah, and as I grew up and thought about things differently, and I have to say, members of my family also changed and thought about these things differently. We realized that particularly unifying vision of things is wrong and harmful. There are other unifying visions of things that you might think are a whole lot better. Like we like the idea that we're going to have laws that we operate by, and if we don't like it, we'll try to change those laws, and we all are going to try to follow the same laws once they are in place. That concept of law is a unifying concept for us that works pretty well in our culture. We do disagree about what the laws should be, but we like the idea of law. So unifying concepts aren't in and of themselves bad. If you're a Christian, you have a concept of God and Christ. If you're a Jew, and another concept, a Muslim, another concept. These are really valuable unifying concepts. But I'm saying, just like empathy, it can go in a great positive direction, or it could be dangerous.
Particularly if you don't ever look outside the unifying concept and see that other people have unifying concepts that are totally in opposition to that.
And in fact, that's where we are with Islam and Christianity right now in the world. And one of my projects, I have to say, is that I've been reading the letters of Osama bin Laden, I thought it would be an interesting challenge to my ideas about dialogic freedom to try to see things from his perspective.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to write about that eventually, but I haven't written it yet. But it'll be a good test of my ideas about dialogic freedom.
Have you done much of the reading yet?
I have. I've read all of his letters. And it struck me that there was nothing that personal about any of it. It was pretty generic criticisms of the dangers of Western thinking and the ways in which America, especially, but other Western influences, have done bad things to people in the Middle East, and nothing too surprising. But
right.
but as you read it, you realize there is a case to be made there. And you can understand why someone like him, who went through what he did in his life, could come to hate us as much as he did. Doesn't make it a good thing. But I'm fascinated by my attempts to try to see things from his perspective.
Right. We'll have to have you back. We're going to keep your phone number for that discussion at a future date. Let's take another call. We have Sharon Schumann with us talking about her book, Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World. Here's Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, hi. Wow, yet another fascinating and timely and really important discussion. We've long known, I think, that the human nervous system is designed to be an exquisite threat detector, and that fear impedes any kind of real empathy or dialogue or communication between people. And there's a neuroscientist named Stephen Porges, P-O-R-G-E-S, who has a concept he calls neuroception, which he describes as a neural process that enables humans and other mammals to engage in social behaviors by distinguishing safe from dangerous contexts. Well, we've kind of known this in a general way, but I think that the neuroscientists are teasing apart just exactly how this happens. And one of neuroception isn't entirely negative, but when it is, it's kind of what they call threat detection without awareness, because it's usually operating below our conscious sensory experience. And then it just gets sent through our whole body, and it causes us to pull back from each other. And so I'm wondering if you've looked at and incorporated any of the neuroscientific findings of recent times in your work.
All right. Thanks for that, Sandy. I get the sense, though, from what I read of the book, though, that it tends to stick with the literature end of things and not so much on the neurological side.
Yeah, but you know what? I have been reading about that sort of thing lately, and there's a second book I want to write that there'll be no literature in it at all, and I'll take on about six polarizing issues. I already wrote about abortion in the first book, but gay marriage, guns, the death penalty, Islam. You know, I'll just think of the most polarizing issues that I can. I want to write about them from the point of view of dialogic freedom. And, in fact, I want to do some research about this neurobiology, because I've been reading about it. And I do think that in many fields, including the sciences, there's beginning to be evidence for the ways in which we work as human beings to try to make sense of our world, or we fail to make sense of our world, or how certain chemicals in our system that get released by various experiences have one effect or another on the way we think about our relationships to other people. I'm fascinated by all of that, and it didn't stop me as a literature person from blundering into the world of political theory and philosophy, so I'll just go stomping towards science and try to incorporate that in my next book. I think it'll be really interesting.
I can sense several other programs we can have you on in future months and years. We have an email here from Jacob in Gold Hill. I'm going to have to edit it a bit because it's very long, but he talks about he's been trying to work across ideological lines on things like gun laws and World Without War, and he says that the people on the other side are not crazy or ignorant, but far too many of them are. He talks about things, particularly with gun rights, where people say things like the right to bear arms is not given to me by the Constitution, but by God. People talk about needing to carry guns in any environment I feel I might have to defend myself. And he says, I find these people to be self-hating, dangerous, and not either worth listening to or empathically capable in either direction. So philosophically, yes, you, Sharon, have a point. In the real world, he says, I find it almost impossible to work toward.
It's funny that particular example was what he talked about, gun control, because I quote in my book, I quote those kinds of statements in gun control as evidence of the problem that we're up against, we're up against the problem where people on both sides think the other side is just incapable of thinking rationally. And that's, to me, that's the illustration of the problem. It's not a reason to despair about a potential solution. Because, see, what I'm trying to do is reach people so that whether you're on one side or the other, you say to yourself, I really want to see how they're thinking and how they're coming to these conclusions. Not just because that'll prepare me better to argue about it in the future, not because I want to pass legislation against them, I want to trounce them in the public sphere next time we get a chance to debate. Not even because I'm such a nice person that I'm willing to think about it from their perspective, just because I'm generous. Not for any of those reasons, but rather, if I can just think through completely why somebody would want to do that, I will be a more free human being to do all my thinking and all my choosing. You have to really consider it of benefit to yourself, not just something that's of benefit to someone else. See, right now, if you're going to cut any slack to someone who disagrees with you about guns, it's because you're such a nice person. I want it to be that I will really benefit from thinking about this more deeply, and it has nothing to do with the other guy.
It's a fascinating book, Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World. You'll love the section on Satan and his powers to understand other people from Milton's Paradise Lost. Sharon Schumann is the author of Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks for the opportunity.